blessed this morning to have Jeannie Love. I'm sorry, Jean Love. Jeannie. Jeannie will present to us a personal odyssey entitled A Process of the Heart. This is a story of hope, encouragement, and reconciliation after unspeakable loss. Jeannie was raised a Quaker and trained in peaceful coexistence and conflict mediation. She is an educator with experience at Whittier Friends School, a musician, a soloist, and a writer. In her business, Teaching from the Heart, Jeannie lectures, facilitates workshops, and helps clients achieve a more active understanding of their surrounding world. She focuses on sharing her particular model for personal growth and healing. Let's welcome Jeannie Love.
She said, you really need to share this program with our friends in Fullerton. And I said, I'd be happy to. And as I look around and I see everything, I've been here before. I'm not a stranger to your group, and I don't come too often. But I love everything that's here about love and everything that was chosen this morning in terms of the reading and the words and everything. It was so fitting for today. Life is what happens to you when you're busy making other plans. When I was preparing for today, it got to be a little difficult because I thought, gosh, there's so many things that have happened in my life and so many things that I've experienced that I have to make sure I'm focused and relevant. And I'm old enough now to have a lot of experiences. But when I first started out, my joy was my music. And of course, as a high school person, I thought that's what I would go into. I would be a musician. And I was classically trained, and I was going to be a concert singer, and everything just seemed to fall into place. I went up to the University of the Pacific with a fabulous conservatory up there. And I found out that I really hated it. Because to them, music was work. And it was 24/7, and suddenly there was no joy in it for me. And I just said, I can't do this. It's not fun for me anymore. So I transferred to Whittier College and decided to become an educator. And that was a very comfortable space for me. I've been in that kind of genre ever since, one way or the other. And I knew that I wanted to be able to sing until I couldn't breathe anymore. And so that gave me an opportunity to use music as something extra special, but not something that got worn out. Music is an opener of the soul. And when we decide that we don't want to listen to somebody talking, we're much more likely to get a message through beautiful music and words and orchestras, etc. So it's nice to be able to combine the two things. I read somewhere that we have to hear something like 11 times before we finally believe it. Well, that's a lot of listening, hopefully. But I don't come here about that. I come here to share a personal story, a journey that I never had envisioned would take place in my life. I got married. I had a child. She was wonderful. I got divorced. Married another wonderful man. Had three more children. And life seemed to be pretty good. We moved around a lot because my husband was an itinerant PhD. He would get a year position here and a year position there. But on the road, we met some incredibly fantastic people. We had good hearts. We intended for the best. We wanted the best for our children. We wanted the best as people living. And as I was sitting here, I was reminded when we lived in Lockport, New York, which is outside of Buffalo, we went to the Unitarian Church in Williamsville. It was a great, great church. And my children still fondly remember their RE program and all the wonderful people we met. And I still have contact with some of them to this very day. But what I wasn't prepared for was the amount of loss that was going to take place in my life. I lost my dad when I was in my mid-20s. He was older. And that was really hard because we were close. But that, you know, I learned to be with that. We moved around a lot, so I lost friends a lot. We didn't have cell phones and texting and all the modern conveniences that keep us in touch today. And I had to learn to plant roots and adjust, get on with it. My oldest daughter started traveling back to Southern California when she was about 5 and a half to see her father and her stepmother. And I didn't realize at the time that there was a lot of abuse going on. And she was a very vibrant, outgoing little girl, but she never shared with me what was going on. So that was the first component of the things that changed all of our lives in the family. We had moved from Santa Cruz, California, a great hippy-dippy town, oh, wonderful, to New Orleans, where my twin girls, Julie and Regina, who used to babysit for the little ones during service, were born. We lived there a year, and then we moved to Charleston, South Carolina, and we lived there not quite a year. And then we moved to Michigan, in Southern Michigan, and lived there for 3. It was particularly there that things began to be kind of tough and difficult, because my husband was a Vietnam vet, and he'd had some issues and had been hospitalized after Vietnam, but you know, they didn't talk about post-traumatic stress then. And he was just kind of willing himself through his life, but he began to shut down and crumble inside. So our marriage started to go through some really difficult times. And it was very frustrating because we were supposed to be the couple. We had all gone through our stuff and we were supposed to make it and, you know, be the couple and be that family and be that wonderful, successful story of love and family and goodness. But that started to fall away. And it was very difficult for me to adjust to that. So we moved again to Lockport, as I mentioned earlier, and it's about a half hour away from Niagara Falls, a beautiful place. And that's when things really started to show and the strains of the marriage began to show, and my oldest daughter, Jordana, I'm going to call her by name, she's given me permission to tell her story today, started to really have difficulties. She had learning issues in school, and as an educator, I was always going into the principal's office and saying, I know. Oh, Mrs. Love, what can we do for you today? But little did I know that when we were living in Michigan, we had a boarder, a person that we knew, and we knew the family, but we didn't realize that he was really inappropriate with our daughters. And so Jordana took the brunt of that. So she had emotional and physical abuse from her stepmother, and unfortunately was molested by this man that lived in the home. Right under my nose. And you read stories about that, and people say, how could that happen right under my nose? Well, it just does. Because you want to believe the best in people. You want to think that you've made good choices. And as a parent, I wanted to think that I put things in the right order for my children. And because my daughter didn't really share with me what was going on, I really didn't have an opportunity to step in the way I needed to. But it began to be apparent that things weren't right for her. When I divorced, I got all of my kids into counseling. I wasn't against that at all. I knew they were going to need some help. The counselor just said, oh, they're fine. Okay, they weren't. But we were managing, and there's the story that I didn't want. I didn't want to be a single parent. I didn't want to have four daughters that I had to raise all by myself. And there was a lot of course things that went on, anger, resentment, judgment, etc., about their dad and his inability to be present and be there with the family. Well, long story short, we moved back to California. My brother had passed away and my mother needed me to come home. And that's when I got connected to Whittier Friends School. And that was a lifesaver. I was raised a Quaker. I had been in public school, but I got really disenchanted with it, and I was tired of it. I don't really wanted to leave teaching altogether, but my mother convinced me I needed to stay. And I'm really grateful she did. Because I was able to step into a situation where I had a lot of control. I could do what I wanted to do, still following state guidelines, so that I was appropriate and we were successful. And I think we were very successful. That was probably the glue that held our family together, having that center, having those friends, having that experience. My daughter in high school, both of my daughters, my first daughter, Jordana, and then my daughter, Kylene, were 2 years apart. And coming back together as a family was very difficult. There was a lot of anger, a lot of resentment. And of course, at the time, I didn't understand how much Jordana was broken up by everything that had happened to her. Even though I was in counseling, it took years for it all to unfold to know exactly the extent of what happened. And I'm only giving you this background so that you can understand what it was that our family faced, what I faced, how I had to come through one crisis after another to find out what the truth was in life. And it's actually very powerful and very wonderful. So through high school years, which were challenging, we survived. And then Jordana barely made it through high school. My second daughter was the whiz. She was the student. She was the one that everybody said, oh, wow, she's bright like her dad. And she graduated from Conley High School, and my other girls went to Rosary, so it's always fun to come up this way. But there was a lot of difficult time. Jordana had been diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. And if any of you know what that's like, it's just one of the most difficult psychological presentations there is to try to find medicine for and to work with. Unbeknownst to me, too, she'd also started to drink and do drugs. I kept her locked down as much as I could, but even then, she was able to find a place to try to drown her sorrows. So we're holding on, and the family's getting mad at me because they feel I'm sacrificing them for her. And if any of you had experience with a child who's had disabilities or who is ill, it is a very difficult thing. And you try not to push the others aside. You try to keep that balance. But as a single mom, and as someone who really did not have a support group, I was unwilling to sacrifice any of my daughters or let any of them go. And at the time, I made that decision thinking, well, my other kids are just going to have to be strong enough and graceful enough and loving enough to deal with this, and I'll pay for their counseling and therapy later. So we lived along and had some wonderful experiences, but there are those highs and lows that everybody talks about. So my second daughter, Kylie, went away to school to Santa Barbara, UCSB. And we moved through that experience, and my oldest started to really fall apart. She got in with people who were heavy users and drug users, and she sold herself for drug money, and all the horror stories that you just don't want to think your child would ever do. How can that happen? How can that happen to me? I personalized an awful lot. I realized later on it wasn't about me at all. It was about what was going on for her. There came a point in time when we really just had to look at this and see what we were going to do about it. She had already tried to commit suicide once as a senior in high school with an overdose of Ritalin. Counseling again assured me she would be better, everything would be okay. But I could feel that she was just a fish out of water, and it was really serious. And I felt pretty helpless to do anything about it except to hold on. At that time, I really didn't quite have the skill I needed to go beyond just the survival mode. My mother was the only one available at the time, and she did not have the psychological equipment to support the situation. Their dad didn't have that kind of, he was very emotionally unavailable. So it was pretty much up to me. When Jordana was 20, she went to visit a friend in San Francisco and decided that was going to be her time for her to really take herself out. So she loaded up on pills and alcohol and tried suicide again in a friend's apartment. And I was at work, at school, when I got the call, and I just went right up there with the clothes on my back to rescue my daughter again in the emergency room. I think it was then when I fully realized how really, really bad it was. And it started the journey of exploration and reading and finding out what was going on. We got her into a rehab. She spent 4 months. She turned 21. And we felt like we had kind of maybe pushed aside, pushed away, bought ourselves some time. We talk a lot about recovery and that usually when they're very young, they're not ready to recover. They still have some years. They're not really ready to make that life change. But we backed up a little bit, breathed a sigh of relief, thought, oh God, she's still alive. Isn't that wonderful? I thought for sure that if we couldn't balance this, she'd be the one that would be in the street and they'd be getting the call from the police about her body being found. My second daughter began to wander then, but not through drugs and alcohol, but through depression. My little girl, Kylene, the light and love of my life, was starting to not be connected to her own life and was exhibiting her own depression. And I didn't quite know what to do for that either. But she started to find ways to keep herself afloat, but it was never moving forward. So my youngest, Julia Regina, became the light of my life. It's not because I disenfranchised myself about my other girls, but at least I had these two younger girls who were very proactive and they were highly functioning. And when mom wasn't available, they had each other. They did that from the time they were little. My friend used to call them the terrible twinnies. So they really were each other's solace and gifts. we walked back into another issue when my mother passed, because my oldest daughter was very connected to her grandmother. And it went into another psychological depression. And she had been living after rehab with some friends and had to come home because she just wasn't able to handle anything. All the while trying different medications and different therapies to see what we could do to balance her. Slowly but surely, she began to pull herself up by the bootstraps. She went over to Cypress College and started to get very active in theater. She's a wonderful actress, singer, musician. And that saved her. And she was very involved, and it was really a family therapy for all of us. All the girls got involved. My daughter Regina became stage manager for several of her shows, and I'm like, oh gosh, took a deep breath. Things are better. Well, temporarily, yes. Until a sequence of events started to become very apparent again. She decided it was time for her to leave Cypress. It was time for her to move on, but she made the statement to all of us that if I quit theater, I'm going to go crazy. And that's pretty much what she did. She got involved with a man who was incredibly abusive, and she already didn't feel very good about herself, so it was easy for her to go under the shoulder of somebody else. And it was just before my daughter Regina got married that I realized I had to let her go. That was the hardest thing at that time that I'd ever had to do, crying anything. And I had a close friend who was a drug and alcohol counselor, and I was on the phone with her, and she said, you have to let her go. Here's the script. You can't let her pull the family down. She was stealing from us, stealing credit cards. She ruined my laptop. She'd done all sorts of really not nice, okay things to do to support her drug habit. She was really hooked on crystal meth. So I have my friend on the phone, on the landline, and my daughter on my cell phone. And my friend is giving me the script to tell my daughter on the other line that she needs to just be free of the family, and that when she's ready to get clean and sober, I'll be happy to be with her, but until that time, she's not allowed home. I tell you, anybody ever doubts a God, there's some experiences in my life where it's just been so clear that whomever you call it, whatever you call it, there is definitely a divine guidance for my presence to have that stepping into and being told how to speak to my daughter, knowing that I had to let her go. I just had to let her go. So the wedding happened, and for about a year and a half, we really didn't know where she was. Once in a while, I'd get a frantic phone call at 2 o'clock in the morning, or Christmas morning, it was 5:30. She doesn't even remember the call, crying and weeping. I don't know what happened. I don't know. Please forgive me, Mom. And we all had to go on, and it was hard. My oldest two were very close. When they were really little, because they were only 22 months apart, my daughter Kylie would run around going, "Where do? Where do?" meaning Juliana. But this separation, because of the alcohol and drug and psychological issues, really drove them apart. And I know that Kylie was very, very broken by it and didn't speak about it a lot, but it would come up. So we let Juliana go. I have a beautiful son-in-law. He really came in at a very hard time for our family, but gave us such strength and courage along with my other children. And we moved on and did the best we could. It was at that time that I really was afraid that she'd be the one that would be gone, that she would be gone. And I just had to let go. But about a year and a half into it, there's something inside me one day. My friend Roy, who's here, we were sitting at the table, and I said, "I'm not giving up on her. I can't. There's something inherent with me." I could hear her calling me, "Mom, don't let me die," which she used to say every suicide attempt, "Don't let me die, don't let me die." She said later, "I was just trying to make myself feel no pain." It wasn't that she really didn't want to exist. She didn't want to exist under that criteria of depression and sadness. So I could hear this inside of me, as a mother often truly does. And I said to Roy, I said, "I had to let her go, but I'm not giving up." And something triggered inside of me. And someone asked me yesterday what kind of work I do and how I do it. And I said, "Well, I do a lot of visualization. I do meditation. And we go in and change things. Thoughts are things. It's energy. You go in and you move it around." So we began this calculated step into calling my daughter home and talking to her from those levels where she could still hear us, and promising her that no matter what happened, we would be here for her in her recovery, that she had to come home. But this time, she had a warrant out for her arrest. Having the police come to your house and talk to you about where's your daughter was worse than anything I've seen on TV. I was a teacher, I was an educator. We'd never had trouble with the law in our family. What was this about? So I faced another part of myself and judgment about how people live and how they can get into those dark corners. And I didn't realize I had a prejudice about it until it came up into my life. So she came home December 7th, 2008, after we had really spent time calling her home. She showed up. We had a big decorating the tree thing going on and food, and my daughters just scattered. They didn't want to see her. They were so mad at her. But one daughter stayed and got on the phone with the police and called them and said, you've got to come arrest her. Because we knew that if she went out again, she would not come back alive. So I was out talking to her, and I gave her a little money to go to Taco Bell because she was really hungry. She came out and gave me a change. I thought, oh my gosh, something is different. And she was looking around waiting because the man that she was running away from was looking for her. So we finally got the police in La Habra to come get her. Wow. Best of times, worst of times. Watching your child in handcuffs go away in the car. But we knew, and we all said it collectively together with a sigh of relief, she's safe now. So this began a journey of understanding about the criminal justice system. And I heard you talking about the fundraiser for CIW. Jordana had been in CIW for a while, and she was in transit. The grace of God or the angels or whatever you want to say was with her, because she could have been in a lot more trouble than she was. She had to do 16 months, most of it at Chowchilla. What an education that was. I have such a deep respect for people and circumstances, but I also have such a difficulty with the way we use prisons as our money system, as you all know. We have more people in death row in California than in Texas, and Texas is supposed to be the real go-get-em state. Joe and I started writing letters, and I hope at some point to be able to publish them because they're incredible. She really details her awakening. She really details how she comes to this truth of who she is. And she really comes to this deep regret and sadness for what she's put the family through. But it was a wonderful connection to a part of her I had not seen in a very long time. And we just counted the days until she could be free. And she was. And I thought, oh my God, thank you. The darkest time of my life, thank you, she's here. Now we're going to rehab. She had a wonderful rehab set up for her. She had things moving for her. And I was really starting to take some deep, deep breaths. And the family was still pretty mad at her. But I knew that eventually she would show herself and her true colors of goodness, and she would reclaim herself. As she was reclaiming herself, and as she was getting herself sober and clean and getting the help that she needed and the medication that she needed, and her sisters watched with bated breath to say, okay, well, we're watching. I said, that's fine. She had just was almost ready to finish her year of rehabilitation. She had been clean and sober. Not quite a year at that point. It was in February of 2011. My second daughter, Kylene, was working, and she had a really horrible job. I said, no, this job's going to kill you, Kylene. I don't know why you're in it. But she was dealing with her own depression, stuff that she had not been able to clear in herself, and as trying as we all did, and we had long, long talks. And I always offered counseling to her, whatever she needed, let's do this. Just as everything seemed to feel really good, I get a call. I get a call from her dad because he's first on her phone list for emergencies, dad before mom. And he, by this time, is in assisted living. He's 100% disabled as a Vietnam vet because of Agent Orange. It's another thing they didn't want to tell you. He was a pilot, but they said everybody that was in Nam was exposed, even in some of the training camps in Georgia here in the United States, because they were experimenting with spraying Agent Orange. So he calls and said, I got this call from an ambulance company that Kylie is down and they've taken her to a hospital. And I'm like, oh my God, I knew this wasn't good. You know, you just had that feeling inside of you. And I was like, no, I can't do this. We're just getting the family together. What's going on? I felt really good about how I had processed my daughter Jordana, how the family was coming along, because I didn't stop believing in her. Because I held her to that highest good, to that light within, to that integrity of, I know you can do this. I didn't let her die inside of me. And I kept reminding her about who she truly is all the time. So I go to St. Jude's because I knew that's where she was. And I go into the emergency room and I speak to the person there and they said, Kylene's mom is here. Are we letting anybody see her? And I thought, oh, this is serious. So as I'm ushered back to her spot in the emergency room, she's lying there looking very awful with oxygen on her. And I got so angry. And I leaned over to her. First of all, I said how much I loved her. I had to tell her the good part first. And then I said, don't you dare leave us. Don't you dare leave me. It wasn't about her at that moment. It was about me. Don't leave me. We got the family together. Things are working because my daughter had a little boy and we had this family growing. And I just could not fathom why my other daughter would be at risk like this. Well, it turned out she'd had a stroke. She was 30. And they put her up on the third floor in St. Jude's where they, the stroke and cardiac unit. And they found out that she had a stroke in her cranium inside, so that they had to have an MR to see it because the CAT scan didn't show it. But she'd lost use of her right side. She had enough wherewithal in the emergency room that she handed me, this, you can't see it, but it's a ring, and it's the ring I bought for her ring for being a Connelly in her junior year. It's the only piece of jewelry she really ever liked that I gave to her. So they put a pacemaker in her because they found out she had AFib. And that settled things down. And at first they didn't know that she was really going to recover. And she proved them all wrong. She'd lost her speech, but she was a fighter. But something still wasn't right. So what happened was, a week after that episode, she had the pacemaker put in, she turned 31, and then the following Sunday night, because they had put her on Coumadin, which is the blood thinner, she had a massive stroke again and bleed all through her brain. And I was there for that one. And I looked at her and I said, what are you doing? Why are you going away? And of course, they had to do emergency surgery because the brain was so swollen. And they had her on all these bells and whistles and intubated, and you know how that goes. I don't want to have to go on to that because it's nothing that really serves purpose to this message. Except to say how trying it was. We called all our family and friends. They were all there. They didn't think she'd get through the surgery, but she did. Okay, because I said, Kylene, if you got to go, you know, she wouldn't want to be a vegetable. There's no way that that child of mine would ever want to be lying there, you know, not being able to have a life. So she came out of surgery. We waited. She wasn't coming out of propofol very well, but she did have brain activity, so we waited. And the ICU doctor said, well, you know, if it was my daughter, she's so young, I would give it all the time we possibly could as well. We had that conversation with the doctor about 10 days after her surgery in the morning, and I went to get my hair done. Well, a few times that I left the hospital. When I get a call, and my hair is all in aluminum foil, I looked very extraterrestrial at the time. There's been a change in your daughter's status. Oh, my word. So the stepmother was wonderful. She came also, and we had shifts. So Kylie knew she wasn't alone. And so Jackie said her heart stopped. Well, so did mine. She said, but they got it back up again. So I ran over there. And the only reason I share this is because the human spirit is just amazing. I was in that ICU a long time, and people were dying all the time. People would come and go, but I never saw a lot of group around a person going through that kind of code blue. When I walked up in front of her room, there must have been 12 people in the hallway, all staff, because everybody in the hospital knew about Kylie. She was so young. And the doctor was so upset. He came to me and says, I don't understand. This is the other part of her heart. How could that go down? We had her on a monitor. She's got all this and on and on and on. He was so distressed. And then he said something that I didn't quite get until later. She was down 20 minutes when they worked on her. He said, I don't know what brain damage is there because of the oxygen. And I went, oh, yeah, whatever. Because I was trying to grasp everything. But basically, we really lost Kylie that night. She never recovered. But the reason I say this is because something wonderful happened with all of that. I mean, people were so incredible. But I also, because of the person I am, had to know what is going on. And I very much believe that we are connected, whether we have the ability to see the other worlds or not. And she started talking to me. And it wasn't just my mother's psychosis and sadness. I'm all right. I have to go. I got work to do. It's okay. It's all right. We took her off life support and took her to hospice. And because we're not in Washington or Oregon, we had to let her die on her own. We took her to the hospice that was loving and kind and beautiful. And my second granddaughter was born in the middle of all that, in the same hospital where Kylie had been. This continuation of life was just impressive. We let her go the 25th of April, 2 years ago, the day after Easter. But she's been more present in our lives. And I'm not just talking about myself. You can ask anybody that's around us than she's ever been. And the reason I share this is because I lost two daughters. One came back. Still is working. She's sober. She's making herself a viable person. She's speaking on panels, going into hospital areas, taking people to meetings, learning how to be alive in this world without the use of drug and alcohol. She has gone through such growth and change, in part because she would not do that to her sister. She could not make her life worthwhile with Kylie being gone. She did get a chance to reconcile with Kylie before. She was able to visit her several times before she went into the coma. And she was able to apologize. And I am so grateful because I don't know what that would have been like. And when they told me that Kylie was basically a vegetable, her brainstem was still functioning, but her upper brain was not working. I just didn't care anymore. But I knew I could get through it. And I knew I could get through it because I had gotten through it with Jordana. And I knew that I had made a choice, and that was to live. And to bring love and joy and happiness and peace and thoughtfulness to everybody who's been through all sorts of similar problems. It's all about choice. It's all about what we choose to do, how we choose to be. Are we going to crumble and be the victim and say, poor me, oh God, poor me? Or are we going to rise up and go, you know, life is continual. It's connected. And everything's temporary. Whether we live 5 days, 5 years, or 90. There's a presence and a preciousness in life that's just amazing if we allow ourselves to make that choice. If we allow ourselves to get rid of our old programs and our old darkness and our old stuff and feel the beauty of who we truly are and how we have that, all of us, inside of us. And it's that knowing and that believing, and we work together as a group of consciousness to help the other person when they're down and give them a hand and bring them up. And then if we're down there, they're helping us up. People said, "Gene, you're so strong. How do you do it?" I don't know that I'm strong. I don't really know if that's what, how you would describe it. I just have a knowing inside of me that's contagious. I have a deep sense of life and of the inherent goodness in people. The times that I would visit Jodanna at CIW when I could, these women were like everyone else, except that they made some bad choices. Of course, a lot of the women in the prison system are there because of drugs and alcohol. But it didn't matter what their circumstance. They were trying hard to be good people and have people love and forgive them. I teach a tool called the Ho'oponopono, which is a Hawaiian tool taught by the shamans. It's a four-phrase statement. I love you. Please forgive me. I'm sorry. Thank you. And this is going to be the last thing talking that I can see. It means I love myself and I forgive myself for any blame, shame, or guilt that I might carry with me. And I take 100% responsibility and don't look out there and say it's their fault. On this Memorial Day weekend, we have a lot of memories. We've lost people, we have a lot of memories. Let us be in that energy with ourselves to know that love overcomes everything, and it's that unconditional love. That unconditional love that forgives. Forgives circumstances, situations, and just is real in knowing that's the most powerful energy in this world. Vanessa and I are going to sing a song to you right now that I wrote about my daughter. She sings Kylie's part, and I sing the mom part. And this is where I got the title for the talk today, Process of the Heart.
Thank you. Thank you very much.